I just can't believe, Bob, that all the people that... I'm not going to put the blame in your lap because it's my fault if Scott completely avoided reading one paragraph, one line, policy paper, anything of the greatest thinker since, you know, probably since Lincoln.
Right. Well,
or even
the happy news is Scott was a member of the LaRouche group
for a few years. Scott did read LaRouche,
right? 15 before you were involved in with it.
I doubt it.
No, he did, Scott.
There was never we never.
Well, I can't compete with Charles on.
No, it's not competing because.
But he did read LaRouche for 2 years. He subscribed to the paper in 94, 95 when you met me.
Yeah. I've given people acquaintances who are like, you know, I'm not going to use the bitch word because I had 2 children out of wedlock, so I got a bitch and a bastard. Were wonderful people. But
let's finish the sentence. You said, even though there are all these people who haven't read LaRouche, what were you going to say about it?
It's like the one of the biggest insults in the world is not having, you know, the a person not having the I'm going to select another word euphemistically instead of decency. Cognitive
acumen
to at least engage somebody who has also read blah 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 blah.
Right,
there's Chomsky. No one to talk to unless a person reads Fidelio.
That's right.
And the Executive Intelligence Review.
I agree.
So I'm completely disappointed and disgusted with the level of sub-intelligence in the Venice, the West Side area, because of the great job that the Jews do in destroying the reputation of the greatest thinker since Lincoln.
Right.
I mean, since
Socrates.
No, since, you could say...
No, since guy that wrote Poor Richard's Almanac, Benjamin
Franklin.
Which I appreciate what you sent me. Now, see, you took that step that I acknowledge.
Yes.
And you Xeroxed an entire section of the American Almanac, which would go right, you know, right by me.
Yeah.
And you placed it on a Xerox machine so that I was able to tape it together with... with a little roll of thin scotch tape and then read it with, like, what's the word, with,
delight.
Yeah, well, Helga's good. Helga's great with sublime, let's say,
sublime aesthetic.
Yeah.
Good.
We can relax. What'd you say?
Taking a little from, let's see, who wrote about aesthetics? Schiller.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's absolutely zero people for me to talk to.
Right.
In all of Los Angeles.
That's because you have such a hard time. That's because you have such a hard time expressing what you've learned from LaRouche. You cite the papers and things that you've read, but let's hear. Let's. I want to learn about LaRouche. So lay it out for me, buddy.
You want to learn about LaRouche? Okay, LaRouche had everything figured out since he was a. In the intelligence unit in Burma, in the mid 1940s, working for U.S. Army.
Since he was 22.
Yeah, and then he had already read all the so-called great philosophers of Europe, you know, and he mentioned Immanuel Kant as one, you know, which he discarded later.
Yeah,
and he liked Descartes. So did the Pope. You know, the Pope that just died recently, a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
He also liked Descartes, but
why did he dismiss Kant, and what does he like about
that's
Descartes?
That's later. That's a later development.
Kant's attack on Leibniz and the discoveries of the classical philosophers and geniuses were ripped apart by
Kant.
Kant and who's that other devil? The one that walked the same Philosopher's Path every day at 3:30.
Was that Kant?
Einstein?
Kant walked the same route every day.
Immanuel Kant.
Yeah, he walked the same
route.
He's
the one, right.
Yeah.
And he had his valet with an umbrella, holding the umbrella at like a 60-degree angle in storms so that the rain didn't go
So there was another guy in his era?
Well, let's see. But anyway, getting back to Scott's question, LaRouche says that if a person wants to gain the insight to discovery for the physical, let's say the physical principles of our universe and so forth, we have to, you know, take hold of the great Archimedes and those people who built things, did things physically. Archimedes, I think didn't he do this screw that brought the water up to a higher level? Archimedes, so screw.
I think so.
And he also.
I'll second that. Yeah. I think so.
Well, yeah, no, isn't he the guy who taught? If I had a lever, if I had a lever, I could move
fulcrum.
The, fulcrum, I could move a lever and a fulcrum, I could move the earth.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then along comes the British foreign intelligence. That's the you know, it's LaRouche was like put himself in too much of a position to be ha-ha'd at, you know, what's the word?
Ridiculed
by the parrot crowd, people that repeat what they hear on right-wing talk shows and stuff like that. And then they would just laugh at him and say he says the Queen of England is a drug pusher.
Yeah.
And they would all go, you know, laugh so hard that sometimes the liquid would come out of their nose.
Yeah.
They were such pigs. Mm. And, you know, I'm not going to be to turn into an anti-Semite because of the destruction that the ADL has done to the LaRouche movement. I mean, they actually tried to kill him.
Yeah.
I mean, the Communist Party and the FBI got together as, you know, two gloves made for one body. And when they went to his apartment and shot it all up and destroyed his files and stuff, luckily he was on vacation. This is when he lived in Greenwich Village and thought all the hippies were just, you know, walking to get a daisy flower to stick in. Oh, Paul Volcker's nose.
Yeah.
Jesus. The LaRouche, the good thing about the LaRouche organization, they're able to help a person get a lot of, can I use the word parasitical media, knowledge, false information off the back. Mm-hmm. It's like carrying a weight. Mm-hmm.
Get rid of a lot of excess baggage.
That's it. See, he's good with words, that guy behind me. On my side of the car.
He's one of your most successful students, Charles.
Yeah.
Who's a student?
Bob.
He's a student of LaRouche.
Yeah.
He's the one that sent 8.5 by 11s of an article about what Benjamin Franklin did for England.
Yeah.
That England didn't have to to have a perpetual war against the United States because of importing, exporting tariffs and inability to match the industrial production that was over here. He actually went there and got a watchmaker from London who could design locks and canals just like they did in my hometown of Lowell. Whistler lived right next to where the locks and canals were. They're incredible. I used to like marvel at them all the time because I went to school on the other side of town. And, you know, they had these huge rivers, two rivers going through Lowell, Mass. The Merrimack River, which was central, and then the Concord River that Henry Trader Thoreau used to sit on the banks and hold hands with his
he's pretty slick with words, too, isn't he?
Male lover. Yeah, yeah.
Henry Trader Thoreau.
Well, I heard that.
Ooh, holy hands.
I'm not a total idiot.
See, I love Elaine. I mean, Ellen DeGeneres, and I personally had met and spent a little bit of time with Lily Tomlin, and they're just two of the most beautiful, funny, entertaining, nice human beings, and they represent a whole movement that the right wing doesn't want their, you know, like, cover your eyes, children. There's a, you know, two women walking along the Venice boardwalk holding hands. Cover the eyes of the Reader's Digest, daughters of the Reader's Digest people. And LaRouche is able to help those who, well, Dave, the guy who used to drive me to the meetings for like 14 years, says, oh, you know, you shouldn't be writing notes when LaRouche is speaking, or the key speaker, keynote, head of intelligence at LaRouche, counterintelligence, rather. I said, Dave, I says, like, weeks and months later, and years later, I reread this, and there's no way I could have remembered everything that they were saying by trying to remember what... I said, I have to write down the good stuff. I got to write down the good stuff. Yeah, I also had trouble with an Asian guy who... When I moved here in 1987, I moved to Hollywood because I could commute to Disney in Burbank and back and forth. And it was nice. And I met this Asian guy who was seeking a religion, something, you know, some Sunday morning affair. And unfortunately, I headed him in the wrong direction. I met him in the Church of Science or something, you know, and it was like a small theater on Wilshire Boulevard that the church says, can we use your theater like for an hour on Sunday, you know? Oh, no problem, you know. No drinks and, you know, Chinese food, you know. But anyway, this guy says, you shouldn't take notes, you know. He says, because you're not listening to what they're saying next. I said, I'm only writing down the stuff that I want to be able to remember.
You are listening to what's next.
Yes, yeah. So, Dave was a good guy, and...
Sounds like a war veteran who died. Dave was a good guy, but he just died. Go ahead, Charles, what were you saying? What about him? Well, what's your point here about...
You know, when the first meeting I ever went to at LaRouche 14, 15 years ago, they were trashing the people who are objecting to nuclear
plants
and so forth. You know, now they have pebble bed nuclear in Brazil and Japan and countries around the world that is plutonium.
The cover of this month's Wired magazine is promoting nuclear energy power plants.
A little bit late.
Yeah.
A little bit late now that the price of gasoline.
They're doing it because the Gaia guy went that way. Lovelock. Lovelock, who trashed for 20 years. Lovelock came up for nuclear power about 2 years ago.
Oh.
So then all the British guys through Condé Nast and Wired magazine start spouting the British line for Mr. Gaia, Lovelock. Right, Charles?
I don't know that.
It's a little late.
Prince Charles is still in opposition, I'm sure.
Yeah.
I read a couple of books by his mentor.
Yeah, the Lawrence guy.
Yeah. Yeah, Vanderpost.
Yeah. I'm going to make a quick phone call. I'll be right back. I'm going to call my report.
Okay. So, carry on, Charles. You were saying you read these books, Vanderpost.
Vanderpost, you know, he was saying, you know, like... put those daisies down the soldiers' rifle barrels.
Yeah.
And anyway, I guess I could play that subject out because reading LaRouche is unloading misinformation, disinformation, lies, and outright strategies to keep people from rising above their station.
Yeah.
and Scott McClellan just put a book out today.
Oh, he just ripped Bush a new asshole.
He not only ripped Bush, but he tore apart Karl Rove and Cheney. He's got Cheney. And also, you know, one of my favorite congressmen is Wexler from Florida, big, big, tall Jewish guy who is such a patriot. And he says he wants a Senate subcommittee to cross-examine Karl Rove.
Yeah, Cheney, you know? I'd like to see that happen. What about you? I mean, should I just take it as a given that you feel strongly that that's the correct procedure?
If I didn't know you any better, I'd think you were putting me on. But
For even raising the question?
I think that the Democratic Party is lucky to have such a dweeb in the White House that they're able to build up their
own image,
their voting, because they got all the college kids.
Yeah.
Most of the college kids, except in theological seminaries, where they're, you know, teaching history 3,000 years ago. You know, like somebody's Sunday.
Does LaRouche favor any of the incumbents now? The guys that are running?
If he puts, you know, some sort of a testimony on any of the candidates, he would have to be crazy, because they see what LaRouche is doing, then they do the opposite. See, LaRouche is always, LaRouche, when he plays poker with these thugs and these scums and these Zionist pigs and so forth, he has his cards pretty much in the open. He doesn't hold his cards close to his chest like the scum do. They see what he's, so they say, hey, gee, whiz, a 9/11 is a good way to get the country into a war mood. You know, like when I read that in the Executive Intelligence in 2001, you know, sometime, of course, before 9/11, I said, God, he's giving those people ideas. I'm not kidding either. I was furious that he suggested a 9/11 as a way to wake up this country. Except that, like, hello, you know. But Scott McClellan, his book is called, What Happened?
You know, yeah, he's accusing the present administration of treason, basically.
Yeah, and he's also mentioned that Bush says he doesn't remember whether he did cocaine or not.
You know, Clinton didn't remember whether he inhaled.
Wow! Clinton is a scum of the earth. And he and his wife with the APAC. Whew. I met a guy in the people in this building here for my birthday. They gave me a $5 what's that coffee, that big Starbucks $5 coffee plastic card. You know, I guess they're reusable. But anyway, I went and got a coffee this morning because I was up at the bank across the street practically. And there's a guy in line, and I went back for some honey packets. And I said, excuse me, to him twice, you know, and then he came over to the condiment table. And we started chatting, and he ends up to be a journalist, a freelancer, and working for the LA Times. But he used to write for the LA Weekly, which was far left. He said the politics in the LA Weekly was more than he could handle. He was glad to go to the LA Times, where, you know, he's getting $1.25 a word. You know, even big words. He gets the same amount of money for the word A as he does for the word manufacturing or something. You know, it's like how many, you know, like they fit spaces or around advertising. Because, see, I worked in the publishing business for years after I left IBM. And the first thing we did was we knew what kind of a cover we were going to have. But we put advertisers in the back, very last, you know, back cover, and an inside front cover. And then at the bottom of a lot of pages up front, and then sometimes in the inside spread, where you can print it as one sheet instead of joining, you know, like two, a photograph cut in half. And what was I saying about the publishing business?
$1.25 a word or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. So what we did was we put the ads in first, and then we string copy around the ads. You know, fill it up, and then put bold headline and a photograph, and if we have a little bit of space left over, we'll blow up part of a story where the words will be like four times as big as the five times as big as the text. But he said, now this is something I wanted to tell you. I thought about you after he left. He said that the younger generation, I said, you mean the cell phone generation? You know, the information technology people? He says, yes. He says, they feel as though they were like short-changed when it came to the 1960s, even though they were born 20 years later. They felt as though the people who were here during the 60s and enjoyed the 60s had something that they could never have, could never get, and they're frustrated about it. Mm-hmm. And that they're dying for for like anything 60s. Yeah. And I guess it's saleable, you know.
What did the 60s people have, you think, of substance that they're dying for, hungry for, or starving for?
Freedom. Because we got fascism now, but we had freedom then. And they know we got fascism now because they've seen the likes of Rumsfeld, Cheney, and especially that that bloated homosexual Karl Rove. Of course, they have like fake wives, like Cary Grant. You know, he had like his wife was his secretary to his publicist or something like that. But anyway, Lily Tomlin's one of my favorite people, and she's.
Who?
Lily Tomlin. I love that woman.
Is she gay?
Yeah, she and her partner, Jane Wagner. Am I yelling too loud?
No.
Because lately people are screaming and yelling, and they're right there next to them. And they think that they're still at home with the TV up too loud, yelling to their mother in the kitchen, get me a beer or something. You know, and they're screaming right in my face.
It's an effect of the cell phone, too. People are always talking.
But what are you saying, Charles? They were screaming where? Where were you? What you talking about Lily Tomlin?
Yeah, Lily Tomlin is a wonderful person, and I just don't want to be raising my voice when I get excited, but I love that woman. And she and Jane Wagner, her mate, her partner, also her manager, they were on their way through Times Square, and I worked in the theater district, like near Schubert Valley, and doing theater advertising and movies and stuff.
I'm gonna move my car. Where's the tape? Just leave it there?
Yeah.
So it's misting one night, and I'm walking to my bus to go to my wife and kids in the suburbs, and there's Lily Tomlin and Jane Wagner coming toward me, and we stopped and we talked for about 10 minutes, and they were on their way to a show that they were in.
Did you know her from before?
No.
Okay.
And then, the next time we met, and she was wonderful. It was misting, it was raining, and we didn't have any umbrellas, neither the three of us.
Why were you talking? What about?
Because I thought that she's one of the most adaptable actresses. I told her that no matter what the part, no matter what the, you know, the premise, I said, she's able to take it so convincingly
and I was talking about a certain movie that she was in. But anyway, to make a long story short, I saw her again in Jeffrey Katzenberg's office when I was working at Disney, because I worked for the creative director at Disney, and instead of him going to Jeffrey, he was the president of Disney at the time, he would send me. I would see her in the hallway, Chuck Midler, I said, was mixed twins from Hicktown in Tennessee. You know, they were mixed up or something. And,
I don't know. I didn't
you know,
see
it was like, you know, it was another one of the Disney's movies that's not offensive. But we knew we recognized each other and so forth. And she stopped, and I stopped, but I kept moving. Because if I get caught talking to a movie star at Disney, I'm out.
No.
The next day. I pack my boxes. Oh. I fill my boxes that afternoon. Tom Selleck used to come to the cafeteria where we ate. And not one person would even consider going up and talking to him. Because
it's that hierarchical, huh?
Terrible. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah. Yeah. But when, one day when I was sitting in the patio... I had been, I was sitting near, the president of the film division of Disney, Katz, I forget his first name, Katz, I was talking to his wife, Campbell. I used to give her the posters. Once we did once we had the posters printed for the film that was just finalized, I would bring her copies. So she'd have them before anybody else. Because her husband was the president.
Mm-hmm.
And she was like secretary to him. But, you know, she turned me on, too, but I didn't. And then, like, one day I walked in there, and she was showing me his office, which was all, like, full paneling. And because it was like a... It was two trailers stuck you know, William Randolph Hearst's wood paneled office. You know, it was like, it looked good, but it wasn't real. And then, like, she showed
well,
me the TV. And I had, like, about five posters rolled up, or three, and it came apart right at her desk, behind her desk. And the two of us crouched. Squat down together, putting them, you know, like in order, and her husband walks in.
What was the actress? Who was the actress?
There's no way, there is no way that I could explain that I had no interest in his wife.
Who's his wife?
Campbell. Her name is Campbell.
Okay.
And,
She was very attractive, and he was kind of attracted to her.
And her husband walked in when he's bent over near her.
Yeah, because the posters...
Touching each other's knees.
Under
almost.
The desk.
Yeah, behind her desk. And she had just showed me his office and so forth. And,
This is Jeffrey Katz?
No, this guy's name is, He had a license plate that says from Auschwitz to to Malibu.
Right.
Whoa.
He's probably born in Auschwitz.
Yeah, he was born in Auschwitz. Yeah.
Katzenberg.
Or Belsen or something, you know.
Yeah.
One of those camps.
He was.